Welcome to the Food Pod for Humanity, brought to you by the Food for Humanity Initiative at the Climate School, part of Columbia University in New York City. This is episode 4 of our second season, which is looking at plant-based diets and alternative proteins. I'm your host, Joshua Luisa.
And I'm your co-host, Danny Din.
Up until this point on the Food Pod for Humanity, our obsession with food has mostly focused on our interactions with it, as humans. There is, however, a common member of many households that is usually overlooked when it comes to their involvement in the food system, our pets. If you have a pet, you've likely spent some time in the pet food aisle, mostly thinking about what brand and flavors they'll actually eat. But just as with us humans, our pet's health is also heavily affected by what they eat. Gone are the days when pet food consisted strictly of bags of dry kibble and cans of generic wet brown mush, or, even earlier, just the table scraps from their humans. There are now specialized products that address specific health needs and even refrigerated offerings for our four-legged friends. This shift created an opening and market for small companies and startups to innovate and introduce new pet food products with more nutritious ingredients that are also more sustainable. Something a lot of us might not have considered is that the same agricultural systems that supply our human food also supply pet food.
According to the Pet Food Institute's 2025 analysis on pet food production and ingredients in the U.S., the pet food sector reported $51.7 billion in sales in 2024. Pet food manufacturers purchased $13.2 billion in farm products that are used as ingredients in dog and cat food. Corn and chicken are the top two ingredients. 1.5 million tons of corn and cornmeal were sold for pet food production, as well as 1.5 million tons of chicken and chicken byproducts.
These ingredients are responsible for all the same environmental impacts that our agri-food systems create when used for our pets, if not worse, because they are subject to less stringent regulatory requirements and lower quality standards than human-grade food ingredients. When we heard about a small company making pet food using alternative sources of proteins, including insects and invasive fish species, we were all ears. In this episode, we're speaking with Gabe Huertas del Pino, co-founder of Archway Pet Food, about what he learned when he started looking into his pet dog's food and how it led him to co-found a company that makes better food for our pets and planet.
My name is Gabe Huertas del Pino, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Archway Pet Food. I actually don't have a pet consumable background. I was an attorney. So I graduated law school in 2014, and I worked in impact law for a little bit of time. It all started with what I'm eating myself when I started eating dogs during the pandemic and trying to find products that were better for them, but also better for the planet. Today, one third of all proteins produced in the country go to feeding our pets. So it's this huge environmental footprint. They eat proteins twice a day. And I thought that maybe we could do something there to make sure that we do something better for the planet. Well, I am health conscious. I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan. I would say I'm more of like a flexitarian, someone who enjoys red meat rarely and is conscious about what I'm trying to eat, both on a health side and an environmental side. I just thought it was unfortunate and unusual that for our pets, since they have usually routine diets, that there's folks who are feeding their pets red meat-based diets two times a day. It was the vet that actually flagged this whole thing for me. We had a pet with food sensitivities. And when we went to the vets, they suggested kangaroo. And my knee jerk was, that's really unusual. Maybe we can do something that's a little better. And what would it be? So then it was just like a Googling of like what types of proteins exist in pet, and was like kind of saddened with the lack of options. The novel protein space is like, you'll see ostrich, you'll see alligator, water buffalo. These are all proteins you'll see at like a pet food aisle. It seemed like the sustainability and maybe like holistic health benefits were just starting to arrive in pet. I'll say if any interested entrepreneur is listening, go to your relative conferences. That's how it started for me. Just sheer curiosity. The concept was there. How do I find alternative proteins for pets? Novel proteins that are food sensitive friendly. That was like the basic concept I was looking to explore. And I talked to a professor at UChicago. I was getting my MBA at the time. And they said, go to a conference and just ask questions. Find the academics in the field. And maybe like this is already going on and you don't need to get yourself involved. So I was both working professionally and I had a job as an attorney and like a manager who had a business. And I was getting my MBA and I was like, I'm going to go to a pet food conference, which is just super goofy of me. Yeah, sure enough, I talked to academics in the field and I was thank like shout out Kansas State University. They're leaders in this. They help run the Pet Food Forum. Right off the bat, they made some of the preliminary introductions to formulationists and nutritionists and some introductions about who was showing up. So there was not any real established players, but people like myself, then like VC-backed early stage businesses exploring this. Quick introductions were made, and that was the very, very beginning. It was enough of a push in my gut to literally build a pet brand. Pets can't speak for themselves and tell you what the problem is when they're having a sensitivity or an allergy. And vets will very quickly either prescribe you something. So you can get a prescription diet with a hydrolyzed protein, very expensive, at risk of sounding critical, but there's also some notions around like the longevity of how good it is for a dog to have a prescription diet. If you're just looking for products that you could buy at a food store up the street or your local grocery store, they will push you to novel proteins. That's the industry term for it. And novel proteins are kangaroo, water buffalo, ostrich, and often fresh fish. There's a whole issue of what type of fish makes it into pet products. So if you care about sustainability and the fish thing is really fascinating. In short, salmon is a very common novel protein. A lot of folks who have pets or sensitivities go to salmon. But when they've done studies on like what type of salmon or what's making it into the pet product that purports to be salmon, there's like a lot of fish fraud across a spectrum of different animals and different species types in fish-based products for pets. There was also a study in Singapore where they went to like closer to 75 to 100 brands, and they found endangered species. They found all sorts of things in the products that make it into pet. When I was first calling around trying to find our fish, so we use a sustainable invasive species, the fisheries were like, don't pet companies just want like our blend? So the first comment I got, like, no, like we're looking for this specific fish. And they're like, no, we do a blend. We sell it to you in metric tons and like you just pick it up. So there's like a, interesting.
As you've heard from Gabe, mislabeling and misrepresentation of ingredients is a well-documented and pervasive problem in pet food. Now, the accurate labeling and the ability to validate ingredients are really important because we certainly don't want to see endangered species mixed up in our pet food, nor do we want to feed our pet food that contain unlisted ingredients that may trigger their allergies or cause serious health issues. There is no shortage of evidence for ingredient mislabeling and false advertisement in pet food, from misrepresented ingredients to toxic contaminations to fraud. We have linked a few of these articles and studies for you in the show notes. In the US, these findings have led to class action lawsuits against violators, which is one of the few avenues for holding pet food companies accountable. When we buy prepared and packaged food, drugs, and cosmetics in the US, we can look at the label and feel assured that the product has gone through quality control protocols and inspections to ensure that they have met safety standards, that everything is properly listed, so you know what you're getting. This is all thanks to the US Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Under this law, the US Food and Drug Administration is responsible for ensuring that food for both people and animals is safe, properly manufactured and adequately labeled. The agency typically considers a product to be food if it affects the structure or function of the body, and this effect is derived mainly from nutrition, taste, or aroma of the product. So a dog food containing calcium that may affect puppy's bone structure, or a cat food containing amino acid taurine that help with cat's heart health would very much fall into the food category rather than drug. This categorization matters because, as opposed to animal drug, food for animals doesn't need FDA's pre-market review to be legally marketed. And unless it is a food additive, food products do not need to meet the effective for intended use criteria. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act still requires that food for animal, just like food for people, be safe to eat, produced under sanitary condition, free of harmful substances, and truthfully labeled. So that's at the federal level. But there's another organization that's very important to pet food safety and regulation that most states refer to in applying and amending their animal feed laws. We'll let Gabe explain.
So I'll give you like the good and the bad. The organization is AFCO, the American Association of Feed Control Officers. They're governed by the FDA. So there's like an agreement between the two of them, which has dissolved. So AFCO was state to state. So it was like this patchwork system. Different states had different feed regulations. So when we would go to a new state, we would register with that entity for feed. And it's like an animal feed office that they all reported into the FDA. That agreement was recently dissolved. And they're now in the midst of an interim agreement about ingredients that were pending, what they're going to do with them. But it's still very much chaotic. And we'll see what the new administration is going to do. So I think we'll have a lot of impact on this type of thing. But generally speaking, prior to all the chaos, it's not too difficult to create pet products. The regulations relative to human or lower standards. We were doing our own testing and our own submissions, but the feed control offices aren't super pushy. So we make a product, we'd send it to laboratories for testing. We would do our own palatability and digestibility studies, but not because the states were asking it. We were doing this mostly for our own research. And it's worth mentioning, there have been hurdles. Insect proteins, which we use cricket and BSFL, which is black soldier fly larva, arguably like the most sustainable protein that like, exists. It's incredible. As recently as like in the last 5 years, they got approved by the FDA for pet feed. Europe, they've been using it for like closer to a decade, but these things were just recently approved. So these hurdles are on the minds of a lot of insect producers because they remember them.
Previously, during the longstanding MOU between FDA and AFCO that Gabe just mentioned, AFCO serves as a voluntary association working to promote a safe feed supply by, first off, develop the definitions for ingredients used in animals' feed and pet food, and then also develop a uniform language that states may adopt or reference in their animal feed laws. This really helps interstate commerce, allowing animal feed and pet food to flow more seamlessly between states without interruptions. While AFCO itself has no regulatory authority, it is still a highly reputable expert body with FDA staff, state, local officials, and scientific experts serving on its board of directors and committee. A partnership like this one helps the FDA's limited resources go much further and be used more efficiently in ensuring the safety and wellness of our pets. Unfortunately, this 17-year-long partnership came to an end in 2024. Currently, AFCO is considering a proposal from Kansas State University to provide the scientific review for its new animal food ingredient submission pathway. It will potentially include a scientific review panel comprised of subject matter experts from universities across the U.S. and independent consultants to provide diversity and representation of all animal species, so not just dog and cat. Together, this panel will evaluate potential ingredient submissions from industry and provide recommendations back to AFCO membership for final approval. Approved ingredients will then be included in AFCO's official publication, which is considered the most comprehensive list of approved feed ingredients in the world. This list is well recognized and utilized by states, international regulatory agencies, and the animal food industry.
The U.S. pet food industry is massive and thriving. As with many sectors of our food systems, the market competition is heavily stacked in favor of brands with the largest retail distribution network and name recognition. And yet, the rising concerns with health and planetary sustainability extends to pet food, meaning there are still entry points for smaller companies to find success through innovation.
According to a new market research report published by Meticulous Research, the pet food ingredients market is projected to reach $73.3 billion by 2031. This growth is driven by the rising pet population, coupled with increasing spending on pet food, growing demand for premium pet food, and an increasing focus on pet health and wellness. There's also a growing consumer interest in sustainable pet food sources, enabling the fast growth of novel ingredients. Essentially, food that's made from an animal source that's uncommon in commercially produced pet meals. More and more, consumers are becoming more accepting of novel ingredients in pet food. Many of the ingredients are readily available and offer a range of health benefits. The fast growth of this market is also supported by a growing number of novel food ingredient manufacturers and increasing research and development investment in pet food ingredients.
Looking at Archway's list of ingredients, there are common healthy stuff you might expect, like fruits, seeds, and nuts. We were most intrigued, though, by their use of insect proteins, like crickets and BSFL, as Gabe mentioned, which stands for Black Soldier Fly Larva. Let's hear from Gabe about these alternative and so-called novel proteins that are probably unfamiliar to the average consumer in the U.S.
We do, generally compare ourselves to specialty products, but there's no reason that you couldn't put us side by side at a local grocer next to any other product. The general hypothesis is that we removed processed ingredients and major allergen groups. It's not a prescription grade product. It's just a product that has better ingredients that's less likely to cause your pet consternation. In terms of where we sit next to the shelf, we often do get placed into a hyperallergenic, food sensitive friendly area of a pet store because we're avoiding these problematic ingredients. We do everything shelf stable. So gently baked, trying to keep the nutritional profile there and shelf stable. A bag of treats can cost you anything between $8 and $14. So we've got these $14 products that have functional benefits. We add supplemental, better for the dog, say hip and joint supplements. We add the classic things that you would find in a chicken or a beef-based hip and joint supplement, but we use sustainable proteins. That's the high price point. And the lower ones are just cookies, little treats that you would feed your dog for training purposes. If you were to look at our competitive landscape, you would most often say there's the hydrolyzed proteins, prescription grade products that will be at the pet stores. Bigger ones will have it, like a Petco might have those types of products. They will also have the novel proteins. So most brands will have a sprinkling of the ones I've mentioned. And then we're one of, five companies maybe in the country that are taking this sort of alternative approach. It's an amazing protein. Just looking at its nutritional profile, you'll see that it has omega fats. It's a complete protein, so it has all the amino acids necessary for an animal. And it's generally high in protein. So it's just here's a good product. And when you look at sustainability numbers, they are remarkable. It's just absolutely mind-blowingly sustainable. We often refer to there's three stats you could look at: greenhouse gas emission, water usage, land usage. An acre can do for BSF 500,000 pounds to a million. Depending on the environment and whatever, it can be vertically stacked. They are astonishing facilities. They're modern. People think of insect farms and their imagination goes wild of what it could look like. They're very high tech. They're closed loop systems and they're almost entirely circular. So they eat everything. The people who are producing BSF are mostly ag and food companies that have waste that they're just utilizing. So to use an example, corn husks, what wouldn't be edible for anybody, BSF will readily consume. We do have to do testing for contaminants, bacteria, so salmonella, you name it. We make sure that we do those at every batch that we use. So that's just also not required, but really good practice.
For our own curiosity and probably yours too, we worked out some rough maths to see just how much more sustainable BSFL is compared to beef or chicken. So for 1 acre of land, you can have one cow, and after 18 months of raising and feeding this cow, you end up with 550 pounds of meat, packed and sold. This 1 acre of land, after 6 to 8 weeks of feeding and raising, could also yield 400 chickens or 2,000 pounds of meat. If you were to raise BSFL on this same acre of land, you may end up with at least 44,000 pounds after just 38 days. And as Gabe said, BSFL are so easy to feed that they're often used in composting and waste management systems. Check out the show notes if you're interested to learn more.
What a goofy adventure. You have no idea, at least I had no idea coming into it, how to find and source some of these proteins. So for insect, There is an established insect industry, but it doesn't feed animals. It feeds reptiles. It feeds fish, aquaculture. So for pets, it was like we need a higher standard, one with greater palatability, that feed the actual crickets better things, so they have better nutritional profile. So we use human grade cricket, and you kind of follow a funnel, right? You go like top of funnel, you go to a conference, and you meet any given insect provider, and then you figure out which are the best ones and why, and you have to do some sourcing. When it's starting that they opened up the world's largest factory outside of Chicago. It's our supplier for our dog food in Decatur, Illinois, this year, 2024. The fish, whole other thing. That was just cold calling. There's not like an established industry for invasive carp. So cold calling local fisheries around the Midwest saying like, have you caught this? How much of it can you catch? What's your plan and how much can you get to us and can you process it? And just like asking these basic questions. Like our newest supplier just opened up recently in the last like year and they do nothing but carp. It's really, really super cool. And that the only note I'd say is that like it's not for a lack of the fish. So like 80% of the biomass, this is their quote, by the way, 80% of the biomass in the Mississippi is invasive carp. It is rampant, it is everywhere. It's just a complete lack of infrastructure. There isn't a fish that we've been farming or catching in the US in local domestic waterways that we've been using for mass production. People might catch like pike, they might catch some of the whitefish, but usually in very small quantities and nothing relative to carp. We're helping build the demand for the first time. These trends in sustainability and better for your dog type products, it's all happened since really since COVID. Fresh products have been around a little bit longer. I'm gonna say the first brand was 2008 or 2007, but even those products don't necessarily look at the sustainability of what they're doing. I'll neg them a little bit. There's sort of a notion that at least like the Costco brand pet foods are finding uses of proteins that would otherwise be wasted. So these meals and like kind of the less savory images that you can imagine making into pet food are finding a use outside of like hot dogs. When you look at these wet products, they are growing animals to be used in pet products. So it's like an extra environmental footprint, in addition to the fact that it needs to be refrigerated and requires power. You have to have refrigerated warehousing, then refrigerated trucking, then refrigerated places on shelf, and then you refrigerate at the home. The power and footprint is actually notable. And when you look at it like for a gram for gram, like one smallish dog having a wet diet, it's a comparable to like half a person just existing in the world. So it's a surprising amount. As an industry whole, we haven't figured out what the audience most resonates with. I would say it depends on the protein, right? They have two different market reactions. Insects fascinating. So it's still trying to find its footing on what people want to take away. There is a temptation to talk about its sustainability. And when you look at like BSF, how could you not? Like it's just so remarkable. But people don't tend to buy on sustainability alone. So this is unfortunate. What these products do their best isn't what necessarily resonates on a shelf. And it's very difficult to educate. If you're looking at just a package, how do you pick it up and tell people a whole paragraph on sustainability and water usage and land usage when they're just looking for a product that makes their dog happy? Having said that, our whole spearhead, whatever expression you want to use, is around food sensitivities and the novel protein element of it, which is something that I think a lot of the brands like ours are starting to consider. And I think it's the right way to do it because people are looking to solve a problem. The problem being their pet having a sensitivity to a common protein and they need something. Vet says kangaroo. I'm like, how about they say insect? How about they say carp?
Yeah, because I mean, I'm sorry, I'm just so stuck on these exotic meats. What do they say anything about the sustainability of feeding your dog in New York City kangaroo? Like, how do they expect you to find this week after week, month after month, year after year? Like,
I guess our thesis is don't buy kangaroo. It's really curious, right? They mentioned nothing on sustainability, and I don't know how you could. Insect, I think, is a little bit more touch and go, popular in urban areas, high educated areas, popular with younger audiences over older audiences. There's a bunch of little things that you can pull on for insect, and the answer is it's complicated. For fish, I'm very grateful because it was the second protein we launched. It's so much easier. We can sell a bag of dog treats for using the invasive carp in rural Missouri. If you're familiar with the problem, and it's a very well-known problem, especially in fishing communities or where there's local waterways that have been affected, which is well over half the country. People know what it is, and they thank God someone's doing something with it. It has a network effect, which was completely unanticipated. We get people who call in and say, like, tell me about your carp product. We're selling to like hunting and fishing stores. It resonates really, really readily. It was a bit of a surprise, if I'm being entirely honest. For us, it was like, how many different sustainable alternative proteins can we explore? And we're a Chicago-based company. This is a real specter of concern that carp will make it to the Great Lakes. It's already causing quite literally billions of dollars of ecological damage. And we could find someone to fish this for us. So as we started making our first products, like it was just a single ingredient pure fish. That way we didn't have to bring it anywhere. Let's just do one processed dehydrated. Our products today are simply a dehydrated fish. And now we probably have like seven different products, but it started with a single ingredient fish product, and the barriers were just non-existent. If I weren't open to eating insect, I wouldn't have been open to feeding it to my pet. I would say the biggest talking point in pet and insect is that humans or owners view their diets, they want a reflection of it, like the way a parent does for a child. They want their pets to eat what they eat. There's a natural connection there. And if you're not open to insect for humans, then you might not be open to insect for pets. But there's a big delta there. Having said that, insect for humans, we've been hearing it since about 10 years ago. It's been really slow to market. I think brands have come and gone. I really like some of the products. I have some in my cupboard. It's like a protein powder that's using cricket. It tastes phenomenal. It's great for your gut. It doesn't have any bloating concerns. There's a lot of reasons to really like it. To answer your questions more directly about like when is it going to arrive or how is reception going, not as good as it could be. And that's just like a truthful response. If I had to like point to the why, I would say it's comes back around to like the marketing of sustainability over its other benefits. The powder I have does a really good job of this. They talk about all the benefits insects provide outside of sustainability. You can't even find a sustainability claim on the packaging. But if you go to the website, and this is, I think, the approach to do, you can read all about the harvesting of insects, how amazing it is, how sustainable it is. But first, give people a benefit. I think that's one of the reasons that it's succeeded so well in the EU is that there's like restaurants that have popped up that feed insects. So your total awareness of it, I think, really helps. And now I give you my negative insect argument that like it's not going as well as it could. The NASIA, North American Coalition of Insect Agriculture, they would murder me for having said what I just said. What I should be saying, it's growing exponentially fast. It might be small, but it's finding a place. Acceptance is increasing. As recently as 2018, acceptance was like 15 or 16%, but now it's closer to like 25, 30. Like a quartile of the people. And I'm like, yeah, but the growth there is 70% in like 3 years, 4 years. It's finding its footing. There's one more thing, education. 30 seconds of education on insect is enough to convert like half of people to be interested in trying it. People just don't know enough about it. And it has to hit a boiling point, which Europe hit before for the sustainability reasons, but like it's happening here. Objectively, data shows we're shifting towards that boiling point. It's just a matter of when. I make that argument all the time. Even if you don't want it, it's just going to show up. We hear that from major pet brands. We've gotten familiar with the five or six biggest pet companies in the space who look at us as like a startup innovator that like they just keep an eye on. We've heard quotes that are, well, you know, whether we like you or not, by 2030, we're going to have something like you because we're not going to be able to source all the proteins we need. That's also something that's like exists, completely agnostic to how we sell our product and what our value props are. All of these pet brands have looked at insect. Carp, I think, is one that they're just starting to like explore a little bit, but they've looked and they know they have recipes on a shelf and they're waiting for the day that the market acceptance is there, that push comes to shove in terms of the prices that they're paying for proteins. It's funny because we think about it and like, is there a global agenda for people to try insects? And I'm like, no, but there's some realities coming around. And like the major brands have spent billions of dollars on market research on their supply chain. They know that this is happening too. Competition, it's inherent in what we're doing. And the big brands are doing it, the small ones are doing it. Like we are going to battle everyone at all fronts because people love their animals. So it was like very natural. People want to join this industry. So there's a ton of startups. And then the majors have been around forever. They're very well financed. They're very big companies. And what makes me thankful is that the big brands don't tend to be super innovative. I mentioned they have all these products on the shelf. They don't make the risk. I don't think they want to stir the pot too much. Most of them keep a very good eye on trends. They might make an announcement or launch a product. And kudos to Hill's. It's like, I think the third or second biggest pet brand. They just launched an insect product. So they have a food in the market that they are selling using insect-based proteins. That's the first major to move. It's happening. And this is maybe my last piece of comfort. And I'm like very thankful for our customer base, which is mostly independent pet stores. They don't tend to trust or buy these big box major brands because of, well, their history. So we have a nice go-to-market and protected distribution channel where we're very happy to be with people who want more transparency, higher quality ingredients, you name it. I'm thankful to say that long-term, I don't think we'll have any or many challenges in terms of profitability. And I say that because today we make money on everything that we sell. We're a startup. So there's like this notion of, do you sell at either a net loss or close to it to get to that growth, to get to that sustainability? And by that, I mean like the sustainability and longevity of the business. We took an approach of being profitable everywhere that we play, which means that our prices are at a premium. And by that, we don't make a ton of money, but we make sure never to sell at zero. So we just have always have a bit of a buffer. And the dream being that as scale happens, we'll become increasingly profitable as opposed to finding profitability. So just making that our basic foundation for unit economics, these things could become much more affordable, both on the insect front and on the carp front, as scale finds itself available. So if you're looking to finance, as an audience member, looking to finance a pet brand or a supplier, the scale is like right around the corner. I really do mean it sincerely. Like you can see it in Europe for the BSF. We pay something like 8 to 12 times more than what the common cost is in Europe because scale is just finding itself. So right now, like even like an $8 bag of treats could feasibly be, if you use my 1 and 8, whatever, it could be $2 or $3 and be competitive with any protein, but it's not the case today. So scale is still happening. And I really hope that in the next 2 years, you'll see it be comparable with everything. Food is the hero product. It's why the brand was built. It's taken us a while to do for study purposes, but also because we don't own our own assets when it comes to manufacturing. That means that to get a co-man to make your product for you, specialty custom recipe, they ask for tens of thousands of pounds. It's one thing to have a twinkle in your eye and say, like, I'm going to make my own pet food. And another to build a distribution network able to take tens of thousands of pounds of product and have the capital to be able to afford it, or at least have like a concept of where it'll go. So it took us a while. And now we're really comfortable with it. And we already placed the order. It will have food in hand mid-March. It's happened. Super excited by it. We'll have two different food recipes. So one using insect proteins, BSF, that sustainable protein I talked about earlier. And the other using invasive fish, the invasive Asian carp. Really excited about both those food products. But having said that, we're also really relatively quite small. We went from 20 stores in 2023 when we launched. We launched like midway through the year. This year, we're closer to 250. And next year, right off the bat, we have commitments from three new distributors. And that's double the current distribution footprint. So like conservatively, if we just keep the same exact amount of growth, it'll be 500 stores. But we have eyes bigger than our stomachs, maybe. We're hoping to get to 1,000, and that'll be in our first 3 years. And then in terms of like what comes next, inherently just in my narrative, I'm like, cats are so neglected. We're making our cat line. So it'll feature almost entirely the invasive carp. A couple cat people readily, I think, associate cat diets with fish. Very low barrier to trying. And there's also like still some regulatory hurdles for insect for cats. That's one of the ones that's being kind of left out in the wind. In Europe, cats are approved the insect, here not yet. So we're actually forced to go this way, but this is the way that I think we would go no matter what, because it makes so much sense. So we hope to have 5 cat products using the carp within the next, let's say, 5 months, 6 months. I have one wish, and this is like to a genie, right? The general wish of like consumers is caring a little more. And I think it's starting to happen organically as folks see more of the consequences of the last, let's say, since the Industrial Revolution, what's been happening around us. like the fires in LA, really eye-opening, right? People see these things. I think that does make a difference in consumer behavior.
Yeah. And you know what? Another tactic too, in the fight for sustainable products, guilt. I think, yeah, assuaging your guilt, feed your, get this like better food for the environment, assuage your guilt from that hamburger that you had like last week, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. When I'm going through like sustainability diets, when I'm like feeling really bad and I'm like, why did I eat chicken last week? I will make sure I put in some powder for like my smoothies and make sure I get my protein that way. It's awesome. You should try it.
I've actually thought about protein powder as a way to slowly introduce people to insect eating. So I'm glad to hear that there are companies that are doing that.
I would look at investors in the protein field. And I say investors, I mean this community right now and like the future of proteins. There's a lot of effort around fermentation and precision-based proteins, cell-based, fancier lab-based types of products that like hundreds of millions of dollars have gone in, and not billions of dollars have gone in and about making these next generations of proteins. My comment would be like, look outside and use what's available. These insect factories are readily available. They make the product affordably with awesome nutritional profile. And I know it's like, insect, but like it's there. It's right there. Same with the carp. One of the things that people knock is like, what's your technology? And I'm like, well, we're using natural biomass for the fish. There's no greenhouse gas emission related to our product or energy outside of just catching and processing. There's things we can do to better the planet, and attention should be drawn to using these natural types of proteins. No offense to any of our fermentation and precision brothers out there. It's our job as alternative protein companies to make people feel like the person they want to be, like to step into the hero role and not hit people with the ruler for not doing these things. So that's like, I think the most delicate part of the dance. How do we empower our audience?
It makes a lot of sense that Gabe pointed to consumer empowerment as a crucial part of Archway's mission, since he began this journey as a curious consumer and dog parent, wanting to empower himself in finding better ways to feed his own dogs. We always appreciate learning from our guests and being prompted to consider the nuts and bolts of our food and agri-food systems, especially sides of it we don't normally consider, like what we feed our pets. Our podcast also seeks to empower you, our audience, to make better informed decisions about what you eat and how you interact with food. As Gabe shared, the pet food industry is listening and responding to market shifts and changes, from consumer reception to ingredient sourcing and pricing. We hope to continue to see more innovative products and sustainable practices in animal agriculture, as well as ingredient sourcing for pet food. This has been episode 4 of the Food Pod for Humanity series on plant-based and alternative proteins, produced and edited by Joshua Luisa, Danny Din, and Alana Schwartz of the Food for Humanity Initiative at the Columbia Climate School. Thank you to our guest, Gabe Huertas del Pino, for sharing his story and insights for this episode. Our theme music is brought to you by Pablo Martin, producer and master engineer based in New York City. Join us next time as our powerhouse summer intern, Alana Schwartz, guides us through what's new in the alternative protein space as we continue to contemplate the future of food. Remember to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already to get that next episode as soon as it drops. If you have any feedback for us, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at foodsystems@climate.columbia.edu. Until next time.